Patience here.
Oh, boy, got some blood going.
Yeah,
blood. He's wearing it too.
Welcome to the bed. When you get over to the bed, we'll go ahead and give you the story. This is all going to happen super fast. Welcome to the emergency room.
70-year-old female, single driver of a vehicle. Appears that she went off-road into a ditch, rolled over her car onto a trailer, caved in. The tongue of the vehicle was caved in, so she was hanging out parked in front of the window.
Okay, let's unpack this. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are opening up what you might call the body's ultimate diagnostic puzzle box, the abdomen. This structure, it's often where seemingly minor discomfort, you know, a little pain here, some generalized bloating there, can hide critical, complex, and frankly, potentially life-changing diagnoses.
Absolutely. The abdomen really is a universe unto itself. And for you, the learner, our mission today as well, it's to move beyond just looking at simple anatomy maps.
Right.
We are building a comprehensive reference guide. We're drawing from deep clinical texts, nursing assessment guides, really aiming to arm you with the why behind the what of critical assessment.
So we're covering the foundation.
Everything. Foundational anatomy, high-yield clinical reasoning, detailed pathology, deep dives into PUD and GERD.
Okay.
And we'll be tracking every step through a real-world client we're calling Miss Chen.
This deep dive, then, it's really designed to establish true critical thinking. We're not just reviewing facts for an exam.
No, not at all.
We're learning how to systematically connect a client's story, their subjective complaints, with the objective, hands-on physical findings you get at the bedside. All right, let's start with mapping the territory.
Yeah.
If we are standing right there at the bedside, what are the physical boundaries defining this abdominal space?
Okay, so the physical borders are essential, right? They define our landmarks for assessment. Superiorly, the abdomen is defined by the costal margins.
Lower ribs.
Yeah, the lower edge of the ribs and the xiphoid process. Then, inferiorly, we look to the symphysis, pubis, and the inguinal canal.
And the sides.
Laterally, it's simply the flanks. And, you know, it's also important to remember the layers of protection there. The abdominal wall itself is made of complex musculature. You've got the obliques, the transverse abdominis, the rectus abdominis.
The six-pack muscles.
Exactly. And they all provide stability and movement, but they can also complicate palpation if the client is tense or guarding.
Okay. So to quickly pinpoint symptoms, clinicians rely on that standard mapping system. We always start with the quadrants. That's the need-to-know structure. It gives us immediate geographical context.
Precisely. So you imagine two lines intersecting right at the umbilicus.
Yeah.
A vertical midline and a horizontal line.
Got it.
This gives you the four essential areas. The right upper quadrant, RUQ, is, well, arguably the most critical and densest. It houses the bulk of the liver and the gallbladder, along with the duodenum, the head of the pancreas, the right adrenal gland, and the upper part of the right kidney. Lots going on there.
So if we move clockwise, the right lower quadrant, RLQ.
Yeah.
That's the one everyone knows for the appendix, right?
Famous for it, yes. It harbors the appendix and the cecum, plus parts of the ascending colon, the right ovary and tube in females, and the right ureter. Pain there is, like you said, always an immediate red flag for appendicitis.
Then we swing over to the left lower quadrant, LLQ. This one's typically associated more with bowel function.
That's right. It contains the descending and sigmoid colon, the left ovary and tube, and the left ureter.
Okay. And finally, the left upper quadrant, LUQ. You called the spleen the stealth organ earlier. It lives here.
It does. The LUQ houses the spleen, the majority of the stomach, the left kidney, the left adrenal gland, and the main body and tail of the pancreas.
Knowing where organs sit in the quadrants is foundational, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But when does that next level of precision, the nine regions, really become critical? You called it nice to know, but important.
It becomes critical when we need to differentiate, say, between vague, generalized abdominal pain and really localized visceral pain. The nine regions allow for super meticulous documentation.
Okay, break those down for us.
So you've got the epigastric region high in the center, the umbilical region right in the middle, and the hypogastric or pubic region low center.
All right.
Then flanking, these are the paired regions. The right and left hypochondriac regions right up under the ribs.
Hypopinae under chondriac means cartilage, so under the rib cartilage. Makes sense.
Exactly. Then the right and left lumbar regions along the flanks, sort of level with the belly button. And finally, the right and left iliac or inguinal regions down near the groin.
So if a client points directly to pain in, say, the right hypochondriac region,
you immediately think gallbladder or liver, maybe even the base of the right lung, but GI is high on the list. It helps you narrow it down fast.
So we've mapped the outside. Now let's go deeper. What happens when you actually press on these organs?
Mm-hmm.
This brings us to that crucial difference between what we call solid viscera and hollow viscera.
Yes, and this distinction is absolutely paramount for palpation. Solid viscera are organs that, well, they maintain a relatively consistent shape and density. Think of the liver, pancreas, spleen, adrenal glands, kidneys, ovaries, and uterus.
And the liver is the biggest one.
By far. Largest solid organ sitting primarily in the RUQ. Its function is just colossal, involved in everything from metabolism and protein production, clotting factors, detoxification, you name it.
And when we assess its boundaries, we're looking for that normal vertical span,
right?
You measure along two lines.
That's the standard. The midclavicular line, or MCL, where the normal span is about 6 to 12 centimeters.
Okay.
And then the midsternal line, MSL, where it's smaller, usually 4 to 8 centimeters. If the span exceeds these limits, percussion will tell you that, and that defines hepatomegaly. Could signal cirrhosis, hepatitis, a tumor.
Got it. Then we have the hollow viscera.
Right. These organs change shape and consistency depending on what's inside them. This group includes the stomach, gallbladder, small intestine, the large intestine or colon, and the bladder.
What's fascinating here, and maybe a bit challenging, is how their anatomical position influences how easy they are to assess. You mentioned that most of the solid viscera, like the pancreas, stomach, gallbladder, especially the spleen and small intestine,
right,
you normally can't even feel them in a healthy person.
That's the key takeaway. Take the spleen, for example. It's tucked way up high under the diaphragm, shielded by the 9th, 10th, and 11th ribs on the left side.
So well protected.
Very. Only if it enlarges significantly, a condition we call splenomegaly, usually defined as being larger than 7 centimeters, will it actually descend far enough to be felt below that left costal margin.
And the clinical significance there is huge.
Immense. If you can feel the spleen, you stop palpating immediately, right then and there, because an enlarged spleen is fragile and there's a real risk of rupturing it with further pressure.
Wow. Okay. We also have to remember the major vascular structures. The big ones.
Absolutely. The abdominal aorta runs right down the midline in the upper abdomen, then it branches into the iliac arteries below the umbilicus. Their location is vital because discovering a pulsatile mass in this region, that's one finding that puts the assessment on immediate high alert.
We'll come back to that.
We will. And, you know, all this anatomical knowledge directly informs our hands-on approach later. For instance, knowing the right kidney sits slightly lower than the left because the massive liver pushes it down, that tells us exactly where to place our hands during blunt percussion over the costa vertebral angle in the back. We adjust our landmark slightly on the right side, making sure we don't miss pathology just because we aimed a bit too high. It all connects.
Okay, shifting gears now. We move from the physical blueprint, the anatomy, to the client's lived experience, the subjective history. You called it the cornerstone.
It truly is. When a client comes in complaining of abdominal pain, you absolutely must apply a rigorous, structured approach. Something like Cold-EspA is perfect.
Let's break Cold-EspA down.
Yeah.
C-O-L-D-S-P-A.
Right. It forces you to gather details systematically. Character, onset, location, duration, severity, usually on a 0-10 scale. Pattern, does it come and go? Is it constant? And associated factors, what makes it better or worse, any other symptoms.
Yeah, and the character of the pain, you said, is remarkably revealing, like a first diagnostic fork in the road.
Often, yes. Let's think about the rationale. If the client reports a dull, aching, or maybe constant pain, that often suggests something stretching an organ's capsule or maybe inflammation inside the organ itself. Think early appendicitis, maybe hepatitis, or even PUD.
Okay. What about a burning or gnawing sensation?
That's the classic description for acid-related disorders. Think peptic ulcer disease, PUD, or DERD. It relates directly to the acid eroding the mucosal lining.
And sharper knife-like pain.
That screams acute peritoneal irritation. The peritoneum, the lining of the abdominal cavity, is highly sensitive. Sharp pain suggests something has perforated, like an ulcer, or maybe there's been a mechanical injury, or severe inflammation like pancreatitis.
And the last one, colicky pain, comes and goes in waves.
Exactly. Pain that waxes and wanes, cramps intensely. That's the hallmark of some kind of obstruction or spasm in a hollow organ. Think biliary colic from gallstones trying to pass, ureteral stones causing kidney colic or intestinal obstruction. The organ is contracting forcefully against a blockage.
Location is obviously crucial. We map that out. But we also have to remember referred pain. That tricky situation where the pain isn't felt where the problem actually is.
Right. It's due to shared nerve pathways during embryological development. So you might have the gallbladder deep in the RUQ, but the pain signal travels up and is perceived in the right shoulder or the scapula.
Wow.
Or pancreatic pain, which classically bores straight through to the mid-back.
Any others that are common?
Oh, yeah. A highly relevant one is the appendix. Initially, the pain from appendicitis is often felt vaguely around the umbilicus, centrally. That's visceral pain. Only later, as the inflammation spreads to the abdominal wall lining, does it localize sharply to the RLQ, that's parietal pain.
And kidney pain.
Kidney pain often refers intensely down the flank and radiates into the groin or testislobia. And as we'll see, that's potentially relevant for Ms. Chen's history.
Okay. Beyond pain itself, we need to dig into associated symptoms. Indigestion is super common.
Very common. But we need to clarify what the client means. Is it just bloating, or is it that burning sensation suggesting hyperacidity? Indigestion can be linked to GERD, pee duty, or sometimes, though rarely, even gastric cancer.
Nausea and vomiting are less specific, right? Could be anything.
Dozens of causes. GI distress, infections, motion sickness, migraines, even psychological disorders. But there's a critical clinical tip here, especially for hospitalized or vulnerable clients. Anyone who is confused, comatose, or has an impaired gag reflex is at extremely high risk for aspiration if they vomit.
So you need to be ready.
Immediately. Positioning them on their side, having suction ready, it's a safety priority.
Okay. We also look for changes in appetite and bowel elimination. Anorexia, or sudden weight loss.
Huge red flags. Anorexia, meaning loss of appetite or significant unexplained weight loss, must be taken very seriously. Could be malignancies, severe chronic conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, IBD, or even profound depression.
And changes in bowel habits, constipation versus diarrhea.
Chronic changes need immediate exploration. Now, normal frequency varies wildly. You know, some people go 3 times a day, some 3 times a week. Both can be normal for them.
Yeah.
But any significant deviation from their baseline pattern, especially if it's persistent, like new ongoing constipation or new persistent diarrhea, that needs investigation. Particularly concerning are symptoms like narrow, pencil-thin stools, which could suggest a partial obstruction or mass.
Before we meet Ms. Chen properly, let's quickly touch on the older adult client.
Yeah.
Age changes things, doesn't it?
Dramatically. Pain sensitivity often diminishes in older adults due to neurological changes. This is crucial. The severe acute condition, like a ruptured appendix or maybe a bowel perforation, might present with shockingly mild subjective symptoms.
So you can't rely solely on their pain report.
No, you have to rely even more heavily on objective physical findings, vital signs, and your overall assessment. They're also at higher risk for nutritional deficits, maybe altered metabolism, decreased taste or smell, making food less appealing, mobility issues, or depression impacting appetite, and one more increased risk for UTIs due to changes in protective bacteria.
Okay, super important considerations. Let's anchor all this narrative now by checking in with our case study, Ms. Chen.
All right. Ms. Chen is a 32-year-old graduate student. Her main complaint right now is a persistent feeling of fullness and bloating, which has been going on for about 4 days.
Fullness and bloating. Okay.
She describes the discomfort as constant, but mild. She rates it only 1 to 4 out of 10. She also reports decreased appetite, and she felt nauseous starting last night.
And a key functional complaint.
Yes, very key. She hasn't had a bowel movement in 4 days.
4 days. All right. What's her history?
Important history here. She has previous diagnoses of GERD. She also had kidney stones, renal calculi about 2 years ago. She's been vaccinated for hepatitis B, which is good.
Okay. Now, lifestyle factors. These often hold clues.
They really do. These are crucial risk cues for her. She reports drinking 2 6-ounce glasses of wine twice weekly. She smokes about 20 cigarettes per week.
Okay.
Her diet is, in her words, poor, lots of snacks, fast food, heavy on coffee. And she's dealing with chronic high stress because of her graduate studies.
Wow. Okay. Ooh. So this raises an important question, doesn't it? Given that whole picture, her history of GI, her past kidney stones, plus these high-risk lifestyle factors, smoking, stress, poor diet, we already have multiple possible avenues to explore before we even lay hand on her abdomen. GI distress seems likely, maybe a GRD flare-up. Could the kidney stones be back?
Exactly. But her primary acute symptoms right now, the bloating and especially the lack of a bowel movement for 4 days, strongly point towards functional constipation, likely compounded, maybe even caused by her high-stress, GI-irritating lifestyle.
And we can't forget the GERD history.
Definitely not. Her smoking history alone immediately puts her at higher risk for worsening GOR because nicotine weakens the lower esophageal sphincter, the LES or even PUD. So the objective exam, when we get to it, needs to work hard to rule out any acute surgical issues while looking for findings that confirm these functional and chronic suspicions.
All right, now we transition to the objective data, what we actually find on exam. And this is where we hit that critical assessment sequence unique to the abdomen. We have to change the usual order, right?
Absolutely. It's fundamental. The sequence is inspection, then auscultation, then percussion, then palpation, IAPP.
Inspection, auscultation, percussion, palpation, IAPP. Why the switch? Why listen before touching?
This is a core clinical reasoning, Pearl, and you really have to internalize the rationale. We must auscultate, listen with our stethoscope before we percuss or palpate. Why? Because the pressure and movement from percussion or palpation can artificially stimulate peristalsis bowel motility. This could increase bowel sounds, leading you to falsely document hyperactive sounds when they weren't there originally. Or it could just change the client's perception of tenderness before you've had a chance to assess it properly.
Makes sense. You want the baseline sounds first. What about preparing the client?
Preparation is key for an accurate exam. You need the client lying supine, flat on their back. Arms should be at their sides or folded loosely on the chest, not overhead. And crucially, knees should be slightly flexed, maybe with a pillow underneath them.
Why the flexed knees?
That helps relax the abdominal muscles. If they're flat-legged, the abs tend to tense up. You also need to warm your hands, and your stethoscope diaphragm cold hands make people tense up immediately.
Good point. And a really critical technique.
Always, always assess the area the client identifies as painful at last.
Last. Why?
If you press on the sore spot first, they'll likely tense up their entire abdomen, voluntary guarding, and you'll lose their cooperation and your ability to assess the other areas accurately.
Okay. What about the ticklish client? That's a real-world challenge.
It really is. A great technique is to use their own hand. Place your examining hand directly on top of their hand, and then use their hand, guided by yours, to do the initial light palpation.
Ah,
palpation. Often the sensation of their own hand distracts from the ticklishness. Another way is just to encourage slow, deep breathing and maintain firm, steady contact rather than light, feathery touches.
Good tips.
Yeah.
Okay, so starting with inspection, what are we looking for?
We're looking at the overall picture first. Skin condition color, any lesions, rashes, contours the abdomen flat, rounded, protuberant, distended, or scaphoid sunken. Symmetry, do both sides look the same?
Normal findings.
Normally, you'll see pink, maybe slightly pale skin, depending on complexion, symmetrical. Contour should be flat or rounded. You might see faint aortic pulsations in the epigastric area, especially in thin individuals. That's normal.
What are the abnormal findings that should catch your eye?
Obvious things like profound distension, which could be gas, fluid, satyrs, or a mass, or a scaphoid abdomen suggesting malnutrition. Look carefully for scars, ask about previous surgeries. Striae, or stretch marks, can be normal after pregnancy or weight changes, but Cushing's disease causes purplish striae. Bulges, especially when the client coughs or strains, could indicate a hernia.
And visible peristalsis.
Right. You might see faint ripples in very thin people normally, but if you see strong, visible waves moving across the abdomen, that strongly suggests an intestinal obstruction. The bowel is trying really hard to push contents past a blockage.
Got it. Any specific inspection tips for older adults?
Yes. A really important one is related to abdominal aortic aneurysm AAA screening. Current guidelines recommend that men aged 65 to 75 who have ever smoked should get a one-time ultrasound screening for AAA.
Why?
Because AAAs are often completely asymptomatic until they rupture, which is often fatal. Inspection might reveal a prominent pulsation, but ultrasound is the reliable screen.
Okay. Moving on to step two, auscultation. Listening. We use the diaphragm for bowel sounds.
Yes, the diaphragm is best for the higher pitched clicks and gurgles of bowel sounds. And you must start listening in the RLQ, right over the ileocecal valve area.
Why start there specifically?
Because bowel sounds are usually most active and consistently present in that area, where the small intestine joins the large intestine. If you hear sounds there, you can then move clockwise through the other quadrants.
What are we listening for? What's normal?
Normal bowel sounds are kind of soft, low-pitched gurgles or clicks. They happen irregularly, not constantly. The normal rate is generally considered to be between 5 and 30 sounds per minute. You don't have to count them meticulously unless they seem very slow or very fast.
What if you hear nothing?
That's a critical point. If you listen in the RLQ and hear nothing, you can't just assume they're absent. You must listen actively and patiently in each of the four quadrants for a full 5 minutes total before you can confidently document vowel sounds as absent.
5 minutes? Wow. Okay. Yeah. What about abnormal sounds? Hyperactive.
Hyperactive sounds are loud, rushing, high-pitched sounds. You might hear prolonged gurgles, often called borborygmy, which is just stomach growling on overdrive.
What do they suggest?
Increased motility. Could be simple gastroenteritis or diarrhea. But critically, if you hear high-pitched tinkling sounds, especially if the client also has abdominal cramping, that's highly suggestive of an early mechanical bowel obstruction. The bowel is contracting hard against the blockage.
Okay. And the opposite, hypoactive or absent sounds?
Hypoactive sounds are very faint, infrequent sounds. Absent sounds after that 5 minute listen mean no motility. These are concerning. They usually signal decrease or ceased motility due to things like peritonitis, inflammation of the abdominal lining. Paralytic ileus often occurs after surgery or with severe inflammation, or late stage bowel obstruction.
So absent bowel sounds are a serious finding.
Definitely warrants immediate medical attention or referral. It suggests the bowel isn't functioning.
Yeah. Still on auscultation, we then switch to the bell of the stethoscope.
Yes, use the bell with light pressure to listen specifically for vascular sounds or bruits over the major arteries.
Which arteries?
You listen over the aorta, midline upper abdomen, the renal arteries, slightly lateral to the aorta above the umbilicus, the iliac arteries below the umbilicus towards the hips, and sometimes the femoral arteries in the groin.
And normally you should hear?
Silence. Normally, blood flow through these large arteries is smooth, laminar, and doesn't create noise.
So what does a bruit sound like and what does it mean?
A bruit is a rushing, swishing, or turbulent sound. It's caused by blood flowing through a narrowed or irregular artery.
Okay, so if you hear a bruit over the aorta.
That could suggest in AAA, the aneurysm creates turbulent flow.
Over the renal artery.
That's highly suggestive of renal artery stenosis, RAS, a narrowing of the artery supplying the kidney. This is a major cause of secondary hypertension.
So finding a bruit is clinically significant.
Very. It points towards underlying vascular disease. There's also a very rare finding called a venous hum, a continuous low-pitched sound usually heard in the epigastric area, which suggests increased collateral circulation due to portal hypertension, often seen in advanced liver disease like cirrhosis.
Okay, that covers listening. Now, step three, percussion, tapping to map density.
Exactly. Percussion helps us estimate the size of solid organs, detect masses, and map out areas of air versus fluid or solid material. The normal sound throughout most of the abdomen is timpani.
Timpani, like a drum.
Precisely. It's a high-pitched, drum-like sound caused by air in the intestines and stomach. You'll hear dullness, a flatter, thud-like sound over solid organs like the liver and spleen, over a full bladder, over fluid like in ascites, or over feces in the colon.
So we use percussion to find the liver span.
Yes, it's the standard way to estimate liver size at the bedside. You percuss down the right MCL from the chest, listening for the change from lung resonance to liver dullness, that's the upper border. Then you percuss up the MCL from the tympanic abdomen, listening for the change from tympani to liver dullness, that's the lower border.
And the distance between those points is the span.
Correct. Normally 6 to 12 centimeters in the MCL. If it's significantly larger, that confirms hepatomegaly. It also tends to decrease slightly with age.
What about the spleen? Can we percuss that?
We can try. Normally, the area where the spleen sits behind the ribs on the left side, mid-axillary line, should sound tympanic because it's overlaying the stomach or colon. If you percuss that area and hear significant dullness, especially if the dull area seems larger than about 7 centimeters, that strongly suggests splenomegaly, an enlarged spleen.
Okay. And there's also blunt percussion to the kidneys.
This is done on the back. You find the costa vertebral angle, CVA, the angle formed by the 12th rib and the spine. Place one hand flat over the CVA and give it a firm thump with the side of your other fist.
What should happen?
Normally, the client just feels a dull thud, no pain. If they report sharp pain upon percussion, positive CVA tenderness, it suggests inflammation of the kidney capsule, most commonly caused by pyelonephritis, a kidney infection, or sometimes renal calculi, kidney stones.
Got it. Finally, step four, palpation. Feeling. We do light, then deep.
Always. Light palpation comes first. Use the pads of your fingers, keep them together, and press gently down about 1 centimeter. Move systematically through all 4 quadrants.
What are you feeling for with light palpation?
You're assessing for superficial tenderness, muscle tone, and any larger superficial masses. You're also feeling for guarding. Is the client tensing their muscles? Voluntary guarding. Or is there involuntary rigidity? A board-like feel suggesting peritoneal inflammation.
Then deep palpation.
Yes, after light palpation. Use 1 hand or 2, one on top of the other, to press more deeply, about 5 to 8 centimeters, 2 to 3 inches. This is where you try to delineate deeper organs and masses. You might feel the edge of the liver under the right costal margin, maybe the lower pole of the right kidney, parts of the colon, especially if there's stool, and you assess the abdominal aorta pulsation midline.
And the critical safety warning here.
Cannot stress this enough. Never perform deep palpation on a pulsatile midline mass. If during light palpation you feel a prominent, laterally pulsating mass above the umbilicus, you stop.
Why?
Because that strongly suggests a suspected AAA. Deep pressure carries a catastrophic risk of rupturing the aneurysm. Document the finding and get urgent imaging.
Okay, that covers the basic sequence. Now, the real clinical reasoning pearls the specialty tests. These are for pinpointing acute inflammation, right? Separating surgical issues from other pain.
Exactly. These are maneuvers designed to elicit specific signs of irritation, usually peritoneal irritation.
What about tests for ascites, fluid accumulation?
There are 2 classic tests, the shifting dullness test and the fluid wave test. For shifting dullness, you percuss the abdomen with the client supine to map areas of tympani and dullness, then have them roll to one side and percuss again. If fluid is present, the dullness will shift to the dependent side.
And the fluid wave?
For the fluid wave, you need a 3rd hand, often the client's or an assistant's, pressed firmly down the midline. You tap 1 flank sharply and feel for a transmitted wave or impulse on the opposite flank with your other hand.
Are they reliable?
Honestly, not very, especially in earlier moderate ascites. They can be suggestive, but ascites is usually confirmed definitively with an ultrasound. So good to know, but imaging is often needed.
Okay, now the big ones. The 4 core tests for appendicitis and peritoneal irritation. Let's start with rebound tenderness.
Also known as the Blumberg sign. You choose a site away from the area of maximum tenderness, often McBurney's point in the RLQ for appendicitis, but can be done anywhere. Press down deeply and slowly, then quickly withdraw your hand.
What's the positive sign?
The sign is positive if the client experiences sharp pain specifically upon the release of pressure, the rebound. That indicates the parietal peritoneum, the lining of the abdominal wall, is inflamed.
And if it's positive?
You stop further palpation in that area. Continued pressure could risk rupturing an inflamed appendix or spreading infection. Document it as positive rebound tenderness.
Okay, 2nd test, the Rovzing sign.
This one's clever. You apply deep, sustained pressure in the client's LLQ, left lower quadrant.
Left side.
Mm-mm.
But appendicitis is usually right-sided pain.
Exactly. The sign is positive if pressing deeply in the LLQ causes pain to be felt in the RLQ.
How does that work?
The pressure in the LLQ displaces bowel gas and contents over to the right side, stretching and irritating the already inflamed peritoneum around the appendix in the RLQ. It's referred irritation. Strongly suggests acute appendicitis.
3rd test, the psoas sign.
This checks for irritation of the iliopsoas muscle, which runs deep in the abdomen behind the peritoneum. There are 2 ways to do it. Either have the client lie on their left side and you passively hyperextend their right leg at the hip.
Pulling the leg back.
Right. Or have them lie supine and try to actively lift their right leg straight up against your hand's resistance.
What makes it positive?
Pain in the RLQ during either maneuver. It suggests the inflamed appendix is lying against or irritating that deep psoas muscle.
Okay. And the 4th appendicitis test, the obturator sign.
This checks the obturator muscle, another deep pelvic muscle. The client lies supine. You take their right leg, flex the hip and knee both to 90 degrees. Then you hold the ankle steady and internally and externally rotate the hip by moving the lower leg side to side.
And a positive sign is?
Pain in the RLQ upon rotation. It suggests the inflamed appendix is deep in the pelvis, irritating the obturator muscle.
Got it. 4 key tests for appendicitis peritonitis. What about the gallbladder? Cholecystitis.
For that, we have Murphy sign. This is specific for gallbladder inflammation. You place your fingers or thumb firmly under the right costal margin, in the RUQ near where the gallbladder sits.
Okay.
Then you ask the client to take a deep breath in.
What happens if it's positive?
A positive Murphy sign is when the client experiences sharp, accentuated pain as they inhale, causing them to abruptly stop their inhalation, what we call an inspiratory arrest.
Why does that happen?
As they inhale, the diaphragm pushes the liver and the inflamed gallbladder down, and it bumps right into your examining fingers, causing a spike in pain, highly indicative of cholecystitis.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. We have all these tools now. Let's integrate these steps and look specifically at Mrs. Chen's physical exam findings. What did we see, hear, feel?
Right. So upon inspection, Mrs. Chen's abdomen was noted to be flat, symmetrical, and pink. No visible pulsations, no bulges, no obvious scars, no visible peristalsis. Looked pretty normal visually.
No. Auscultation.
Auscultation confirmed normal bowel motility. We heard about 10 bowel sounds per minute, present in all four quadrants. Soft gurgles, nothing hyper or hypoactive. And critically, no vascular bruits were detected over the aorta or renal arteries.
Good. Percussion.
Percussion yielded generalized tympani throughout most of the abdomen, which fits with her subjective complaint of bloating likely a lot of air or gas. Her liver span, however, was percussed and found to be normal at 8 centimeters in the MCL.
And the kidneys.
Yeah.
Given her history of stones.
We did CVA blunt percussion, and it was negative bilaterally. No tenderness elicited, which makes a recurrence of her kidney stones as the source of her current discomfort much less likely.
Excellent. Now, palpation. This is key.
Very key. Light palpation revealed no guarding, no rigidity. Deep palpation found no pulsatile mass near the midline, so no immediate concern for AAA.
But was there any tenderness? She reported discomfort.
Yes, but it was mild and somewhat diffuse. She had mild tenderness noted over the xiphoid process area, epigastric, potentially related to her GR history, over the aorta, which can be a normal finding in thinner individuals, and importantly, mild tenderness over the cecum, RLQ, and the sigmoid colon, LLQ.
Okay, and the crucial specialty tests.
Yeah.
Blumberg, Rovsing, SOAS, obturator, Murphy's.
All negative. No rebound tenderness. No pain in the RLQ with LLQ pressure. No pain with hip extension or rotation. No inspiratory arrest with RUQ pressure.
So what's the primary message from all this objective data? What does it tell us?
The objective findings are highly, well, protective in a way. The normal liver size, the absence of any signs suggesting ascites, and especially the complete lack of positive acute inflammatory signs, those negative specialty tests, it contrasts sharply with what you'd expect if she needed immediate surgical intervention.
So the negative Blumberg SOAS Murphy signs essentially rule out the big acute surgical emergencies.
They make acute appendicitis or acute cholecystitis highly unlikely as the primary cause of her current presentation. It guides us away from that path.
So where does that leave us? What did correlate?
The mild tenderness found specifically over the cecum and the sigmoid colon becomes our strongest objective clue.
Which are parts of the large intestine.
Exactly. These are the areas where stool accumulates, especially the sigmoid colon before defecation. Her mild tenderness there aligns perfectly with her subjective complaint of not having had a bowel movement for 4 days.
Okay.
So her objective findings steer our focus away from acute organ inflammation, like appendicitis or cholecystitis, and strongly towards functional issues, a likely GER flare-up, given her history and epigastric tenderness, combined with significant constipation. Both of these are highly influenced, probably exacerbated, by her reported high stress and poor diet.
This seems like the perfect time to dedicate some serious focus to the pathologies Ms. Chen is either suffering from right now or certainly at high risk for. Peptic ulcer disease and GERD. We need to go beyond just naming them. Let's dive into the pathophysiology and critically the management.
Absolutely. Let's start with peptic ulcer disease, PUD. And it's important to stress, this is not just simple heartburn. We're talking about open, painful sores, ulcers in the lining of the GI tract, usually in the stomach, gastric ulcers, or the first part of the small intestine, the duodenum, duodenal ulcers, sometimes even in the esophagus.
What actually causes these sores to form? What's the pathophysiology?
It really boils down to an imbalance. The GI tract normally maintains a delicate balance between aggressive factors like stomach acid, hydrochloric acid, and the enzyme pepsin, and sometimes the bacterium H. pylori and protective factors.
Protective factors like?
Like the mucus layer lining the stomach, bicarbonate, which neutralizes acid, adequate blood flow to the tissue, and chemicals called prostaglandins, which help maintain that protective barrier. PUD occurs when the aggressive factors overwhelm or break down the protective ones.
And the two main culprits that tip this balance.
They illustrate this perfectly. First, infection with the bacterium Helicobacter pylori, or H. pylori, this is huge. This spiral-shaped bacteria colonizes the stomach lining, and it actually produces enzymes like urease that neutralize acid locally, allowing it to survive, but also directly damage the mucosal cells and provoke inflammation, weakening the protective layer.
Okay, so H. pylori is one major cause. What's the other big one?
Chronic use of NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Think ibuprofen, naproxen, aspirin.
How do they cause ulcers?
NSAIDs work by inhibiting enzymes called cyclooxygenase, COX, which reduces inflammation and pain. But, oh, these COX enzymes are also needed to produce those protective prostaglandins in the stomach lining. So when you block prostaglandin synthesis with chronic NSAID use, you reduce mucus production, reduce bicarbonate secretion, reduce blood flow to the lining. Essentially, you strip away the stomach's natural defenses, making it highly vulnerable to acid damage.
Got it. What are the typical symptoms of PU? Can it be silent?
It can be silent, especially in older adults or those on NSAIDs. But when symptoms occur, the most common is a gnawing or burning pain in the epigastric area. It's often described as a hunger-like pain.
Is there a difference between stomach and duodenal ulcer pain patterns?
Yes, classically there is, and it's a key clinical distinction. Duodenal ulcers often cause pain that is actually worse when the stomach is empty maybe 2 to 3 hours after eating, or it might wake the person up at night. And here's the kicker. This pain is often temporarily relieved by eating food or taking antacids because they buffer the acid.
Okay, and gastric ulcers.
Gastric ulcers, conversely, often cause pain that worsens soon after eating. Food stimulates acid production, which then directly irritates the ulcer in the stomach.
What are other more severe symptoms we need to watch for?
You might see bloating, belching, nausea, vomiting, feeling full quickly, fatigue, or unexplained weight loss. But the most critical complications involve bleeding.
Bleeding. How would that present?
It can present as hemodiamnesis, vomiting blood, which might look like bright red blood or like coffee grounds if it's been sitting in the stomach acid. Or it can present as melina, black, sticky, tory stools. That black color comes from blood that's been digested as it passes through the GI tract from an upper source, like the stomach or duodenum. That's a medical emergency. Perforation is another rare but life-threatening complication.
Okay, let's talk risk factors. Which ones can people control?
These are vital for client education. The biggest controllable risks are definitely NSAID use, especially high doses or long-term use. The risk is even higher if NSAIDs are taken along with other meds like anticoagulants, warfarin, corticosteroids, prednisone, SSRIs for depression, or bisphosphonates for osteoporosis.
Wow, those combinations are risky.
Very. Other controllable risks include smoking or chewing tobacco. Nicotine seems to impair healing and might increase acid production. Excessive alcohol consumption can irritate the stomach lining. And while stress itself doesn't cause ulcers, untreated chronic stress can potentially worsen symptoms or delay healing. Spicy foods don't cause ulcers either, but they can certainly aggravate the pain if an ulcer is already there.
What about non-controllable risks?
The biggest is infection with H. pylori. You get it through contaminated food or water, usually in childhood. Certain genetic factors might play a role, and very rare conditions that cause massive acid overproduction, like Zollinger-Ellison syndrome.
So management clearly involves tackling these causes and risks.
Absolutely. If H. pylori is found, usually via breath test, stool test, or biopsy, the treatment is combination antibiotic therapy to eradicate the bacteria, usually along with acid-suppressing medication like a proton pump inhibitor, PPI.
And if NSAIDs are the cause?
The goal is to discontinue the NSAID if at all possible. If pain relief is still needed, maybe switch to acetaminophen or a different class of drug, or sometimes a QX2 selective NSAID might be used cautiously under medical supervision as they are theoretically less harmful to the stomach lining.
And client education is key.
Paramount. We need to teach about meticulous hand washing and food safety to prevent H. pylori spread, taking any necessary pain relievers exactly as prescribed, maybe with food, and being aware of the risks. Avoiding or limiting alcohol and definitely stopping smoking. Learning effective stress management techniques. And, crucially, reporting any concerning symptoms, immediately worsening pain, vomiting, feeling faint, or those black tardy stools.
Okay, that's a thorough look at PUD. Now let's shift to gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, which we know Ms. Chen has a history of. This isn't ulcers, but acid going the wrong way.
Exactly. GERD is defined by the chronic pathological backward flow reflux of gastric acid and sometimes other stomach contents up into the esophagus.
What's the primary cause? Why does the acid flow backwards?
Pathophysiologically, GIUD is usually caused by a problem with the lower esophageal sphincter, or LES. This is a ring of muscle at the very bottom of the esophagus where it joins the stomach. Normally, it acts like a one-way valve, opening to let food down, then closing tightly to keep stomach contents from coming back up.
So in GERD, that valve is faulty.
It's either generally weak or relaxes inappropriately and too often. We call these transient LES relaxations. This allows that acidic stomach content to splash back up or reflux into the esophagus.
And the esophagus isn't built to handle that acid, right?
Not at all. The stomach lining has special protections against acid, but the esophageal lining, squamous epithelium, doesn't. So chronic exposure to acid causes irritation and inflammation esophagitis.
What are the potential long-term complications of that chronic irritation?
They can be serious. Over time, the esophagitis can lead to scarring and the formation of esophageal strictures, basically. A narrowing of the esophagus tube, which can cause difficulty swallowing, dysphagia.
That sounds bad. Any others?
The most worrisome complication is Barrett esophagus. This is where, in response to chronic acid damage, the normal squamous cells lining the lower esophagus actually change type. They undergo metaplasia and become more like intestinal cells, columnar epithelium.
Why is it dangerous?
Because these changed cells in Barrett esophagus are considered precancerous. They significantly increase the risk of developing a type of esophageal cancer called adenocarcinoma. That's why people with chronic, severe GERD often need periodic endoscopies to monitor for Barrett's changes.
Okay, what are the typical symptoms of GERD? Is it just heartburn?
Heartburn pyrosis. That burning sensation behind the breastbone is the hallmark symptom, yes. But GERD symptoms can be incredibly varied and often extend beyond the chest.
Like what?
You need to ask about regurgitation, the feeling of acid or food contents coming back up into the throat or mouth, especially when bending over or lying down. Also, look for atypical or extra esophageal symptoms. Chronic hoarseness, laryngitis, a persistent dry cough, especially at night. Worsening asthma symptoms, acid can irritate the airways, dental erosion, and that weird feeling of a lump stuck in the throat called the globus sensation. Even non-cardiac chest pain can be caused by GERD. Halitosis or bad breath can also be a sign.
Wow, quite a range. What puts someone at risk for developing GERD?
There are several factors, many of them mechanical or behavioral. A major one is obesity, especially abdominal obesity, which increases intra-abdominal pressure, literally squeezing stomach contents upward.
Makes sense.
A hiatal hernia, where part of the stomach bulges up through the diaphragm opening into the chest cavity, disrupts the normal LES function and is a very common contributor. Pregnancy also increases risk due to hormonal changes and physical pressure.
What about lifestyle risks, like Ms. Chen's?
Big ones here. Smoking is a major risk factor because nicotine directly relaxes the LES muscle. Eating large meals distends the stomach and increases reflex potential. Lying down soon after eating removes the help of gravity.
Are there specific foods?
Yes. Certain foods and drinks are known to either relax the LES or directly irritate the esophagus. Common triggers include fatty or fried foods, spicy foods, chocolate, peppermint, spearmint, caffeine, coffee, tea, soda, alcohol, tomatoes, and citrus fruits. Identifying personal triggers is key.
Any medications that worsen it?
Yes. Certain medications can relax the LES or slow stomach emptying. Examples include some asthma medications, calcium channel blockers for hypertension, antihistamines, antidepressants, sedatives, and even aspirin or NSAIDs can irritate the esophagus directly. Connective tissue disorders like scleroderma can also impair esophageal motility.
So the management plan for GERD sounds like it's going to be heavily focused on lifestyle changes.
Hugely. For mild to moderate GERD, lifestyle modification is the absolute cornerstone of treatment, often even before medications are tried extensively. It requires a real commitment from the client.
Let's outline that detailed lifestyle plan. What do you tell someone with GERD?
It's a multi-pronged approach. First, avoid triggers. That means completely stopping smoking and avoiding or significantly limiting alcohol. Dietary changes are crucial. Identify and avoid your specific trigger foods. Keep a food diary if needed. Generally, reduce intake of fatty fried foods, spicy foods, mints, chocolate, caffeine, citrus, tomatoes.
Eating habits matter too.
Absolutely. Eat smaller, more frequent meals, maybe 5 or 6 small meals instead of 3 large ones. This reduces stomach volume and pressure. Also, eat slowly and chew food thoroughly.
What about timing and position?
This is critical. Do not lie down for at least 2 to 3 hours after eating. Give gravity time to help empty the stomach. When you do go to bed, elevate the head of the bed by 6 to 8 inches.
How do you do that effectively? Just more pillows?
More pillows usually just bends your neck and isn't very effective. You need to elevate the entire head of the bed frame using sturdy blocks under the legs, or use a foam wedged pillow designed for GUD that elevates your whole torso.
Is there a best side to sleep on?
Yes, a great clinical pearl based on anatomy. Try sleeping on your left side. Because of the natural curve of the stomach, sleeping on the left side tends to keep stomach contents pulled away from the LES junction. Sleeping on the right side seems to worsen reflux for many people.
Interesting. Anything else to avoid?
Avoid activities that increase intra-abdominal pressure, especially right after eating. That means no bending over, stooping, or lifting heavy objects. Also, avoid wearing tight clothing, belts, or waistbands that constrict the abdomen. And weight loss, if overweight or obese, can make a massive difference.
Okay, we've just done a deep dive into PUD and GURD. Now let's bring it all back to Ms. Chen. Given everything we know, her history, her lifestyle, her subjective complaints, and those objective exam findings, how do we synthesize this? Where do her symptoms really point?
Well, Mr. Chen presents with a clear history of GERD, and her current lifestyle factors, the smoking, the high stress, the poor diet, heavy on coffee, align perfectly with known exacerbating factors for a GER flare-up.
Right.
While her main symptoms now are somewhat vague, that fullness, bloating, mild discomfort, nausea, decreased appetite, they definitely fit within the spectrum of GRD or general GI distress.
But the objective exam was key, wasn't it?
Absolutely crucial. The lack of sharp, localized pain, the absence of fever, and especially those negative specialty inflammatory signs, the negative Blumberg, SOAS, obturator, Rovsing, and Murphy signs, this is what strongly pushes the diagnosis away from acute surgical issues like appendicitis or cholecystitis.
And so the physical exam provided critical negative information.
Highly valuable negative information. It allowed us to rule out with reasonable certainty at the bedside the immediate life threats.
And what about the positive findings, the mild tenderness?
The mild tenderness found over the cecum and particularly the sigmoid colon becomes the strongest objective clue correlating directly with her reported 4 days of constipation. That's where stool would be accumulating and potentially causing some discomfort and bloating.
So pulling it all together, the clinical reasoning points towards?
It points heavily towards a functional issue rather than acute inflammation or damage. The most likely scenario is a flare-up of her chronic GERD, likely combined with and significantly worsened by severe constipation. And underpinning all of this is her high stress level and poor diet, which are undoubtedly fueling the entire cycle, potentially worsening her GRD symptoms and negatively impacting her GI motility, leading to the constipation.
So her case really highlights the importance of analyzing the data for actual signs of inflammation, like a positive Blumberg or SOAS sign.
Exactly, versus more functional or chronic distress symptoms like bloating, generalized discomfort, or tenderness related to constipation. The physical exam, done systematically, allowed us to make that critical distinction. It guided us away from thinking emergency surgery and towards conservative management focused on her GRD, her constipation, and addressing those significant lifestyle factors. It's probably worth briefly reviewing some other significant abnormal findings we might encounter during the exam, things that would definitely dictate urgent action, just to solidify why recognizing these is so important.
Good idea. What about finding enlarged organs on palpation or percussion, like hepatomegaly?
Right. Finding hepatomegaly, a liver span significantly over 12 centimeters in the MCL, or maybe a palpable liver edge that feels firm, hard, or nodular that requires context. A hard, nodular liver might suggest cirrhosis or a tumor. A liver that feels enlarged but is soft and tender could indicate acute hepatitis or even venous congestion from right-sided heart failure. The documentation needs to describe not just the size, but the consistency and any tenderness.
And splenomegaly, and the large spleen.
If you percuss dullness where you expect tympani in the spleen's location, or if you actually palpate the spleen tip below the left costal margin, remembering to do this gently, that's splenomegaly. It can be caused by lots of things. Trauma, infections like mononucleosis, chronic diseases like leukemia or lymphoma or portal hypertension.
And the safety point again?
We have to reiterate. If splenomegaly is suspected or confirmed, document it clearly. And all clinicians involved must avoid any deep or aggressive palpation in the LUQ to prevent the devastating complication of splenic rupture.
Okay, what about that vascular abnormality we keep mentioning, the aortic aneurysm, TURAT?
This is probably the most dramatic, palpable finding. You'd feel a distinct, laterally pulsating mass, usually in the epigastric area just above the umbilicus. It feels like it's pushing your fingers outwards with each pulse, not just upwards. It's often, but not always, accompanied by an audible bruit over the aorta and maybe a wide, bounding pulse.
And the action.
Immediate start to palpation. Urgent notification of the physician. This requires prompt imaging, usually ultrasound or CT, and vascular surgery consultation. It's a time-sensitive, potentially life-threatening finding.
Are there other enlarged organs we might feel?
You might palpate an enlarged gallbladder, usually felt as a smooth, possibly tender mass merging with the liver edge in the RUQ, often associated with a positive Murphy sign if it's cholecystitis. Or occasionally, an enlarged kidney might be palpable, typically as a smooth, rounded mass felt deep in the flank. Kidney enlargement could suggest a tumor, cyst, or hydronephrosis, swelling due to urine backup. Unlike an inflamed kidney, pyelonephritis, these enlarged kidneys are often not tender.
And let's quickly revisit abdominal contour abnormalities.
Right. A distended or protuberant contour, if it's not simply due to obesity or pregnancy, needs investigation. Is it generalized, suggesting gas or widespread fluidocytes? Or is it localized, suggesting a large tumor or mass? For clients with significant distension, especially post-op, or those at risk for fluid accumulation, monitoring daily abdominal girth measurements at the umbilicus can be a key nursing intervention.
And the opposite, a scaphoid abdomen.
A scaphoid or sunken abdomen is also abnormal. It suggests severe malnutrition or cachexia, wasting.
Okay, so once we've gathered all this data, subjective and objective, the goal is validation and documentation.
Exactly. Documentation isn't just listing findings. It's about demonstrating your data analysis. You need to cluster the relevant cues, group together the related subjective information and objective findings to formulate valid clinical judgments or nursing diagnoses.
So for Ms. Chin, how would we cluster her cues? What are her main risks?
We'd cluster her subjective report, stress, poor diet, coffee smoking, constipation history, GE day history, current bloating nausea, with her objective findings, mild epigastric and sigmoid tenderness, negative inflammatory signs, normal vital signs. This clustering leads us to identify clear risk cues.
Such as?
Risk for imbalanced nutrition, less than body requirements due to decreased appetite, nausea, poor diet choices, risk for constipation, already present, related to diet, stress, possibly meds geared. Risk for ineffective health management related to lifestyle factors like smoking and diet impacting her chronic GERDA, and maybe even risk for fluid volume deficit if her nausea led to poor intake or vomiting, though that wasn't prominent yet.
And this analysis drives a management plan.
Precisely. It dictates the interprofessional management rationale. Her immediate needs involve managing the constipation, fluids, fiber, maybe stool softeners, and the GERD flare, likely starting or adjusting acid-suppressing medication like a PPI or H2 blocker. But the broader long-term goal connects directly back to the physical exam and history.
Meaning education.
Meaning intensive client education. Reinforcing the rationale for every lifestyle change we discussed for GERD and gut health. Making sure she truly understands why smoking weakens her LES, how stress directly impacts her GI motility and acid production, and how her dietary choices are contributing to her physical symptoms. The management is heavily behavioral and educational, supported by medication, not primarily procedural or surgical based on these findings. Hashtag tag outro.
We have covered a huge amount of ground today. We've really completed a full circuit, starting with mapping the abdomen from the basic four quadrants to the detailed nine regions, moving through mastering that unique IAPP assessment sequence and understanding why it matters, delving into the specific techniques and interpretations of those critical specialty signs like the Robsing and obturator and Murphy's.
Hands-on skills.
And finally, taking a really deep dive into the pathophysiology, the risks, and the detailed management strategies for PODID, seeing how it all played out in Mrs. Chen's real-world scenario.
And I think this deep dive really reinforces that central idea. In abdominal assessment, the subjective story, the client's history, it absolutely must be meticulously reconciled with the objective findings from your physical exam.
It's not one or the other.
Not at all. Ms. Chen's case was a perfect example. A functional problem her constipation and GERD flare presented with concerning symptoms, but it was the careful, systematic physical exam, especially those negative specialty tests, that effectively ruled out a surgical emergency at the bedside. Assessment is truly a holistic investigation.
So the final takeaway for you, the learner, what does this all really mean for your practice?
I, I'd say the next time you encounter a client presenting with vague abdominal complaints, maybe some central discomfort, bloating, remember this. The most valuable diagnostic tool isn't always the fancy imaging technology down the hall. Often, it's the careful, methodical, step-by-step application of that IAPP sequence combined with your knowledge of anatomy and pathophysiology and the relentless pursuit of the underlying why. What's the mechanism causing this specific pain or symptom?
That search for the why.
Exactly. If we connect this to the bigger picture, consider the impact of something like chronic untreated stress. We listed it as a risk factor for both PUD and GERD, and it was clearly central to Ms. Chen's distress. Now, think about how that stress might manifest physically during your assessment.
How so?
How might anxiety-induced voluntary muscle tensing, that guarding reflex, complicate your ability to palpate effectively? How hard can it be sometimes to distinguish that benign anxiety-driven discomfort or guarding from true involuntary abdominal rigidity, which is a much more ominous sign of serious organ pathology or peritonitis?
That's a subtle but critical distinction.
It really is. Learning to make that distinction reliably during palpation, separating the psychological from the pathological based on the feel and the client's response, that's your signal to keep exploring, keep refining your assessment skills.